Today's episode is Nordic passwords are made from chips, salt, fat, paint, and zombies. This is episode 26 of season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me is Mr. Miles Elam, a pedant, a software engineer, a political junkie, and a man about town. Hi.
How's it going?
I hear you're looking for work, and I'm very excited to see what happens, because being the genius man you are, I'm sure that relatively soon you will have a job at some company, which we won't be able to talk about as much. So
that's one of the great things is the companies I've been looking for are smaller scale. They're not these expansive mega conglomerates of multinational corporations. So I feel like I will be able to speak more freely and not have to censor or not necessarily censor myself, but
because you're saying
edit
that they won't have National News Weekly.
They will not have National News Weekly.
Your first story just sounds completely insane.
How would you react if a company asked you, if Netflix said, hey, can we inject a microchip into the meaty part of your hand in between your thumb and your forefinger, and that will let you get snacks and open doors? Like, that'll be your key fob.
You're talking about like a glass beaded RFID chip in my skin. I've actually wanted to get one for a while, and when I was first getting into them, and I went and looked and found one that was relatively cheap, and the warnings on it was, this is not for bodies. Do not buy this for bodies. And they're like all over. Now it's a glass bead. It's like obviously okay for bodies in the sense that, well, it's glass. So
it's inert chemically, and at the same time, it's a foreign body that you're
right.
introducing.
And they don't. I mean, obviously, you don't want to do this unless you want to do that. But I never got around to actually getting one and injecting it in my body. If my employer asked me to do that, I'd be like, hell no.
Wisconsin.
What kind of snacks can you get with it? Can you get special snacks?
Probably the standard fare for a company. Three Square Market, a Wisconsin company, is offering employees implantable chips to do these things. Although a lot of people might prefer the chips in the form of like jewelry. Like I'd wear a ring. Something like that, an NFC ring. Especially if I could use that ring to get access to multiple things. Like if I could have it unlock my phone or something.
Or
like
your
that.
Front like, door.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. Yeah. It's tempting. I mean I have in my back pocket a little disc the size of a quarter that's a really thin piece of paper that has of course a coil and an RFID. And I use that to get into the Netflix building.
Sure.
And I just haven't stuck it to anything because it feels like, why? You know, I was just going to
right. On the pro side, if you have it implanted, you never forget it.
Last night I was drilling in my shop. I was trying to make it's funny. I was actually making a holder to hold Xacto blades because Xacto blades are kind of dangerous when you have them on like rolling around on a table because they can roll off and stab you in the foot. And so I'm drilling this board and I'm thinking in my head, I should really probably put a vise on this, but my workshop is new and I don't have my vise set up. So I'm holding it with my hand and my wife comes out and she's like, hey, Lyle. And I go, yeah, I'm just doing that. And I stab myself in the spot where they'd want to put an RFID chip in my hand. So it's all bloody and sore.
Nice.
So if only I'd had an RFID, I could have just used that impaled wound, just stuck it in there. These little things are like a grain of sand, a grain of rice, excuse me, about the size of a grain of rice. And they've got a little RFID chip in them, just like, you know, other things in your life that have these things.
Yeah. Have you ever had like a small cyst or, you know, a scab or something like that, that's something that's under your skin?
Have I? Let me tell you. No.
For a lot of people, I'm sure it's true. But when I've had one, I've always wanted to – I couldn't stop myself from touching it, from fidgeting with it.
That's something you want to hear. No one wants to hear this, Miles.
Well, no. This is something that comes into foreground with regard to implantable
– objects.
Objects that – you know, the desire to fidget with them, that same desire that has people, you know, like my partner wanting to pop blackheads on my back or something like that, you know?
I got to edit this audio now. So
why?
Because it's disgusting. People eat, you know? People have lives and have to eat. Greg's backing you up, sure. I get what you're saying. I don't like what you're saying, but I get it. You know, I remember years ago we talked about the people that embedded little magnets in their fingers to sense electrical flow and current. That would be something kind of cool because you're not being tracked, but you still have some fidgety in your ring.
Well, this isn't.
You wear a ring. Yeah. Do you fidget with your ring?
I do. I'm probably one of the few people, well, I guess not few people, but I am one of those people that I've never quite gotten comfortable with the wedding ring. There are some times where, like, I don't think about it at all.
Uh-huh.
And then other times where I'll be laying in bed and, like, I'm conscious of it. And so I just take it off and put it on the nightstand and I put it back on when I wake up in the morning. And maybe it's also because it's kind of loose. You know, I've lost a little weight, so I think maybe it's gotten a little loose. But whatever.
What were we talking about? Oh, yeah. What is it? This Wisconsin company wants to inject their employees with trackable IDs. I mean, the whole idea is that it's simpler, right?
It's not like GPS tracking, but it's whenever you have...
Yeah, it's only 5 feet of distance. Right? 2 meters, right?
Right, but it's something that it interacts with the signal. The signal's coming from someplace else. Citrix is an antenna, you know, NFC, but... So
is it RFID or NFC, and what's the difference?
Sorry, it is NFC.
Okay.
It is near field communication.
All right. What's the difference?
I don't know.
We'll have to look that up. Range. Greg Merkley says range is the difference. Thanks, Greg. Well, cool. Hey, we have a correction from a few weeks ago. If you were listening to the episode, AIs Get Burnt Out on AR, episode of Geek Speak, which was a few weeks ago, Ben mentioned a book that he was just starting to read called Salt, Fat, Acid, Heat, a cookbook. And listener Scott wrote in to say, I'm a few days late to the podcast, so I'm sure I'm not the first to mention it, but the author, Salman Nosrat, is a woman. Ben attributed gender as a male. The discussion about the book was great, but knowing how conscious you are of the show about gender and race issues, I thought you would appreciate the correction. Also, on a side note, the book is based on a cooking class she developed with the same name, which she taught in San Francisco. Good correction. Thank you. Of course, Ben apologizes that he thought of it right away. He just forgot to then correct himself.
Yeah, and your altered voice kind of trailed off and became your actual voice.
I just take on identity, man.
You're like Kevin Costner in Robin Hood.
Dude, you really starts, wait, why didn't insult me like that?
Starts off with an English accent and just kind of trails off and just give up by the time he gets to England. I love that. He gets to England and the English accent goes away. But he's in the Middle East.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
You know, I get that movie and Men in Tights interspliced all the time. Fantastic. Good parody. Hey, Microsoft is killing an application that is near and dear to many a geek's heart.
Yeah. Microsoft Paint, not just geeks.
Microsoft Paint.
Yes. After 32 years, it's going to stop getting any updates. And
have you seen those beautiful pieces of art that people have done with
that? Yes. Yes. The thing about Microsoft Paint that was different from many other graphics programs is that you required essentially zero training. Like anyone could start up Paint,
sure,
click on things, and start doing stuff immediately. There was no training program. You can't do that with Photoshop. Like I couldn't do that with GIMP.
You can do that with Mac Paint.
Okay.
I remember the first one I ever played with the Mac was at my sister's boyfriend's house, and I stayed up all night drawing a picture pixel by pixel. It was fantastic. I wish I had that file still. I'm sure it was not very good. Yeah, but I agree that the easy foray into software really is beneficial sometimes. The GIMP, by the way, I was chatting with someone. What were they doing? They were doing
the graphics program, not the
graphics program.
Not the movie character.
I was chatting with someone that was doing extremely complicated I can't remember what it was now. But I said, you're using, what are you using? Illustrator for that? Or, what are you using? And he's like, yep, GIMP. I'm using the GIMP for that. I'm like, whoa, that's patience.
Well, the GIMP
declare what it is, please.
GNU Image Manipulation Program.
GNU Image Manipulation Program. What does GNU stand for?
GNU's not Unix.
And what does the G in GNU stand for?
GNU's not Unix.
Self-referential
acronyms,
wonderful. Anyways, it's kind of like the open source alternative to Photoshop is what GIMP is.
Yes. And Photoshop is more polished. It does many things. Well, yeah, it's GIMP was made to be a Photoshop clone, if that tells you anything. So that means it was playing catch-up for quite some time. And Photoshop has quite a few features that GIMP does not. That said, GIMP has scripting features that were made for, you have an idea of how to use it. It's tailored more toward
the
geeky community.
The GIMP scripting system is its own language. So you have to get...
It's called ScriptFu, yeah.
Yeah.
No, actually, you can write stuff in Python.
Oh, can you?
Yeah. and so there are a lot of these scripts that you can download for the GIMP that people have said, like, hey, this isn't available in Photoshop. So you download this script and you install it into GIMP, and then you have this feature, only a little bit
slower.
It's ad hoc. Yeah. Many times it'll be slower, but it's
just ad
hoc.
But we're not talking about GIMP, which is not dying. It's available completely. We're talking about Microsoft Paint.
Right, which is, if you're on Windows, what is the easy to use, anyone can fire it up and go program?
Why don't they just take Microsoft Paint and open source this code, and then somebody can compile it for AssemblyJS, whatever that stands for.
Oh, AssemJS.
AssemJS. Yeah. And then we can all run it in our browser. That'd be fantastic.
Well, because no one does AssemJS anymore. It's all about WebASM. WebAssembly.
Really?
Yeah, WebAssembly.
All right. If you say so. Hey, let's go ahead and go to the Nordics now, shall we, sir?
Yes, it's been a bit of a security goof where the Swedish government, the Nordic countries in general have a fair amount of information online. Well, unfortunately, due to a security snafu, almost all Swedes' information was leaked online through driver's license data.
You mean their national driver's license database was shared accidentally?
Yes.
Via hacking, I'm assuming?
Yes.
That's unfortunate.
And how it was done, you can read more on the site by linking. But the issue is this back and forth between, do you support more transparency? And then what happens when people get access to it? Because you may even have information that you say this is not overly sensitive, but there are just people who are trolls that want to get information for nefarious purposes, for abusive purposes.
Mm-hmm.
And this mainly came into the fore when I was reading about Norway, who does something that is so foreign to my American ears that, of course, I perked up and went, huh? They do what?
We just moved from Sweden to Norway.
Yes.
Okay. So the Swedish authorities thing, though, all this data being shared, basically this is all Swedes that have driving age and above?
Yeah.
Jeez. That seems pretty severe. I've got two friends at work that I'm going to have to harass tomorrow. Thank you very much for that information. All right, go on to Norway.
The hole has been plugged, but who knows what...
How much leaked out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Norway, everyone's salary, everyone in the country, the salary and how much they pay in taxes is open.
Oh, right. It's public information.
Yes.
Yes. Salary. Yeah.
Right. Now,
what's the problem with that, dude?
Well, it can be used to be, abusive. And what I mean by abusive, you look up and see who's making more money than another. And then you find out where that person lives, and that's who you target to go rob them.
Right.
That's the danger. It's not so much the information itself, it's how it's being used. And so how do you combat stuff like this? This is the trade-off between security and transparency. So how do they avoid that? Well,
hang on a second. Let's say that's the case. The truth is, though, where you live, your community of where you live is a better target in some sense of your wealth, right? I mean, just knowing someone's identity and their wealth and how much money they make does not – I mean, you need to learn where they are.
Not necessarily. Someone who has a typical house that looks fairly typical from the outside may be a multimillionaire, whereas another person is just a workaday person.
Like Breaking Bad family. They had a normal house, but they were really wealthy.
I was actually thinking the houses that Mark Zuckerberg has in Palo Alto. He has a collection of five houses that are right next to each other, and he's trying to reorganize. But if you look at photos of the houses that have been published online, speaking of privacy, and they don't look out of the ordinary. And this is Palo Alto, so all the prices are heavily inflated.
They're all worth $2 million a piece anyway. Right. Let's go on to the Norwich thing.
But there's a big difference between his next door neighbor, who may be a millionaire, and Mark Zuckerberg, who is a billionaire.
Yes, totally true. So what is the situation in how do they make public everybody's how much tax they pay and what their salary is? What are they doing to help protect people's? I wouldn't say privacy, but security.
Yeah, what they're doing is you can look up anyone else's info, but then that person knows that you were looking at them.
Oh, so you have to log in to look this information up.
Yes, this is only available to Norwegian citizens.
Oh, fascinating.
And so any Norwegian citizen can go and look up. And it used to be in a big book that people could look through. And there were some issues. Like, they have had some growing pains where, you know, had the kids at school bullying each other because one parent was richer than another.
Is it socially acceptable to look someone's salary up?
Yes. Although at the same time, the fact that everyone's salary is made available, it makes employment deals and unions a lot easier.
Sure.
It normalizes whole fields for how much they're paid. So
Miles, I've heard the argument that it's beneficial for the individual to share salary information. If salary information was publicly, it would be better for individuals. That the privacy is actually better for companies.
I believe, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's completely socially unacceptable here.
There is a stigma put onto you by employers in a lot of ways. And a lot of people don't like to say how much they make because then you get into these uncomfortable conversations of, we have the same job, but you're making twice as much as I am. And perhaps we need to start having those conversations.
Well, I mean, another part of this, let's say you find out if someone's making more money than you, you have to look at whether there's an inequity or whether they're just better at their job than you are.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to be self-critical.
Yep.
At that nature. I know I make more money than you, but that's because you're unemployed.
Well, I'm pretty sure when I become employed, I'll be making less than you because you work in Netflix.
There's
Netflix
that.
Pays sure. very well.
You know, it's funny. We have a lot of transparency at Netflix, but we don't talk about salaries and, you know, amongst each other.
It was something that happened at Google. Someone started up a spreadsheet, and
did they just look it up, or did they ask people?
They asked people. They said, "Put down your salaries." And so a bunch of Googlers like signed on to this. You know, it's a Google Sheets. Google employees use the same tools as outside.
Yeah,
and you start putting in. You know, you put in your name. You put in your level, and you put in your salary.
Why are people doing that? Did you participate?
I didn't.
Why not?
I think I was busy doing other things. I think I was pretty sure I wasn't.
I was invited to an app, and I used it for a while, and I can't remember what it's called, unfortunately. But you could only create an account if you had an email address of one of the, you know, top 20 companies, and they'd send you a random code, you know, supposedly non-associated code and random username, and then you'd log in with that. You had to have the email address of the company. And then you would be labeled that you work from that company, but your identity was completely hidden. And I played with it for a while, and it was kind of interesting, and salaries were talked about, and rates and stuff. And I just finally got disinterested because, of course, the idea of being anonymous online has never been compelling to me. Like, I don't like the idea of an identity that's not really me. That's why all my usernames are my name.
Yeah. And there's also that question of when you anonymize like that, it's hard to tell. Like, okay, here's the average and here's the variance, but what's the correlation? Like, were you able to put in ethnicity or gender?
No, I don't think so, no.
Because that would have been interesting.
Well, actually, it's really just like a forum, a public forum, where you can talk amongst your company or you can talk generally with everybody, but then there's like a thread. It's kind of like a message board, right? So someone writes a post, hey, what's, you know, salary and comp? What's it look like at, you know, for senior UI engineer?
Sure.
And then everybody would post and say, well, at this company, I make this. At this company, I make that. And then people were like, hey, you really make that? Wait, what's your stock? You know, and it's kind of like a discussion. So it wasn't structured hard. But there would be a thread like, what's your salary? And then everybody would post in there. So it's kind of interesting to see that. What I really learned from it, actually, was quite a bit how the different companies compensate and how you can translate those. Because it's very challenging to understand what salary and stock options and health benefits and other intangibles at some level mean per company.
Right.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's and that's also the thing here when you have information out there, whether you can act upon it.
Hmm.
When everyone all their information is available, that means that as a society you have this huge force, a market force as it were, to act upon, and that can be corrective. When things are more ad hoc, like they are in the U.S., where you have some people put out information, other people don't, many companies actively discourage employees from sharing that information because it could be for an employer, it's obviously disruptive. You may have hired someone who, you know, lowballed.
Yeah.
And they're doing a better job than the other person where they just, you know, ask for a higher number and so they got it. You know, what happens when that person who is making more, you know, is just as useful as the one who's making less, but then the person who's making less makes a stink about it and they go, oh, well, we're going to make the at parity. Maybe you're being paid too much. That person may just leave.
So a quick rapid follow-up from Greg, who posted into our chat, a wonderful How Stuff Works article about what's the difference between RFID and NFC, written by Nathan Chandler. So here it is, everybody. NFC stands for near field communication, while RFID means
radio frequency ID.
Yeah, identification. Very good. Both employ radio signals for all sorts of tagging and tracking purposes, and sometimes replacing barcodes. NFC is still an emerging technology. RFID, however, is in current widespread use all over the world. And RFID tags contain an antenna and a memory chip that stores data. To see the data, you need an RFID reader, and these tags and readers use in a whole bunch of applications all over the place. And then the NFC technology is a newer and more finely honed version of RFID, and it operates supposedly at a maximum range of about 4 inches, 10 centimeters, and can be set for one or two-way communication. So they have similarities and all that. Near field, the whole idea of it is that's really near field. But the truth is that radio technology doesn't work that way. You can go broader range depending on your sensitivity and power mm-hmm. implementation. So though it's designed to be only 10 inches, I'm sure, 10 centimeters, I'm sure that it can actually operate a lot further. So if you're currently using something like Google Pay on your phone or Apple Pay on your phone, you are using NFC mm-hmm. technologies. And if you've stolen a piece of clothing or bought a piece of clothing, they forgot to remember the tags, and you walked out of the store, that's RFID that catches you. Good?
Yep.
Moving on, I wanted to talk to you about passwords because, hey, fun passwords.
We've had quite a few shows about it.
The long and the short of our password conclusions is that you really need to have a unique password for every site because a site will get hacked. Like if you're a Nordic driver.
Yeah. Or more to the point, passwords suck.
Yes, passwords are horrible.
And the thing is, it's not so much that anyone thinks that passwords are a good idea who knows anything about security. It's the transition to something else is not clear.
Right.
Not everyone has the same hardware, has the same capabilities available to them, and a password is anyone who has access to the website can generate a password.
Right. So it's crucial to keep your passwords different, especially on these sites you don't use very frequently but are kind of unimportant. You don't want a whole bunch of shared passwords because, of course, over time, one of those will get breached, and then all of those will be problematic, and you'd be surprised how much trouble people can get into taking your identity on even sites that you wouldn't think are important. Or didn't at one time think it was important. In any case, the solution to the password problem is definitely second-factor authentication. I use a software algorithm tool on my phone that allows me to log in to things that are really important to me. And it's actually required for logging into work. And that, of course, is the Google Authenticator, which actually you kind of create a key and you hand that key to it, and then it can create 1 minute or shorter, long duration temporary right. passwords for secondary authentication, which basically means my phone has to be on me to log into Google.
Yeah, also known as a one-time pad. Yes. So it's a number that every minute it's a new one that's based upon a specific key code when you first set it up that's unique to you as a person.
It's so, almost identical to a secure ID if you've ever had one of those little fobs on your keychain. It used to be that way, but now that we have phones, you can run these. And additionally, the barcode that you currently scan with the software on your phone, you can actually save that image, print it out, whatever, and you can reuse that on a different phone. So sometimes I'll have two phones because I do a lot of testing, and so I'll take the scan the barcode with both phones. Both phones actually then have the ability to use the one-time authentication system.
Right. Now, the reason for this two-factor is that not only would you put in a password, but it guarantees that you have a certain physical device with you on a person. It's not something that can be done through an automated attack remotely.
And automated remote attacks can be mass done, but physical attacks are a lot trickier. Somebody has to actually go look at my personal, you know, my records to find out where I live and then steal my phone.
Yeah.
Okay. So I wasn't going to talk about that exactly. What we were going to talk about is that since you have to have a new password for every single site, and passwords are horrible, and you can't memorize lots of them, because if you can memorize them, it's not a good password. So you can, you know, you can memorize a 20-digit random thing. I've done that. That's what I use. Or it might be less or longer than that. Doesn't matter that much. But that's what I use for my master password. So the trick what you do is you take a master password that you do memorize, and you use some kind of security vault that encrypts all your passwords. And then you use a whole bunch of really like random generated passwords for every site and have this collection that is encrypted by your personal password. And then that giant blob of passwords, anytime you want, you just look it up and you use it. That's personally what I do, and I use an application called 1Password. You, Miles, what do you use? Or do you want to be secretive?
I'll be secretive.
Okay. Miles uses something of this nature as well, or a very clever trick, which is not true because humans aren't clever. So, in any case, generally, 1Password has been a great app. LastPass is another good option. LastPass has traditionally always had kind of a they store your password database, if you will, encrypted, but they store it for you. And this is beneficial because if you lose your computer, you don't lose your entire archive of all your passwords, which would mean you'd be locked out of everywhere. 1Password has a different pattern, or used to have a different pattern, where you had to handle your archive yourself. And the way I first started doing that, it was store it between my laptop and my phone. And then over time, I actually started using other syncing services. And keep in mind, this archive is actually relatively safe to share because it's encrypted really well, theoretically. Is that a good basis for how 1Password works?
That works.
The cool thing about these apps, 1Password, LastPass, whatever, is they have plugins for your browser. And therefore, when you visit a website, let's say I go visit Amazon.com and I haven't put my password in, I can click on a little link in the browser interface and it will come up with a dialog where I can then put in my long password to unlock my archive. And then it will look, oh, you're at Amazon.com and here's the password for Amazon, and it will automatically fill it in for you at your request. This is extremely beneficial when using browsers. And they also have a feature the same inside iOS and Android devices. So does LastPass, and so does some open source solutions. Recently, 1Password's been operating on a new model, and they've been running it for a while, but it seems to be getting more and more aggressive that they would really love it if they could collect a continual revenue so that they can write their software. Because the truth is, software has to be maintained. And for software to be maintained, you have to pay people to maintain it. And so if I sell you an application for $20, in 4 years, I either have to keep working off of that $20 and make it work again for you, or I have to charge you some more money. Mm-hmm. And we've seen over time, we talked about Photoshop earlier. Adobe did this a while ago. They moved to kind of a recurring revenue where you pay a monthly fee. When it comes down to it, if you're continually upgrading and improving the app and offering new features, it does make sense that every once in a while you'd pay more money for it. It's got new features. You know, Photoshop now can do 3D painting. You know, it might be something you want to do. But for applications like 1Password, it's very tricky to say it's going to be better and improved, because it's not really. It's going to keep on doing what it does, maybe a little bit of improvement.
Well, security improvements can always happen, bug fixes. And in the security field, those bug fixes are expensive.
Yes.
The expertise required to do so and to push it out It's more so than many other fields, and I have a great deal of respect for it. So I can see the reason for wanting to have that subscription model, but at the same time, it's a hard sell.
So 1Password has been moving to this model where, hey, we'll host the file for you, and you pay us, you know, $5 a month, and because of that, we'll make sure it's synced, and we'll keep the software updated. And actually, it's a pretty good deal in the sense that I know a good company is paying attention to my needs. The problem is this idea of trust and security. And there's this great concept of trust no one. The only way you can be really assured that your secrets are secret is if you don't share them with anybody. And so if you have a pattern where, for example, 1Password would host all your passwords for you and they could look at them, then I have to trust, for me to know that my passwords are safe, I have to trust every employee at that company and maybe other vendors and stuff like that. So they're not offering that option. They're saying, you encrypt it with your root password. We'll save it for you as this big blob we can't get into. And anytime you need to access, you can log into our site, provide the password, and we'll unencrypt it for you, and you can get access to it. And they're planning on doing this in a very good way, in the sense that that blob will be downloaded to your browser's cache, and your browser's cache, using web encrypt, I think it's a protocol, a suite of libraries of protocols in the browser, will unencrypt that and access the file. So it's relatively safe. And I get the idea of that, but right now I perceive that I know where my archive is. I've moved it the way I've wanted to move it. I've always managed it well. And so I'm not in a place where I have to go, I wonder if that archive is safe. Of course, I have to know my password. But the idea of once I let go of that blob and put it somewhere else, then I'm questioning whether it hasn't been breached. Now, what does breaching this archive mean? It means that someone has to slowly try to crack it. And they can do that by slowly guessing my password. And I already said in the show that it's 20 characters, which is actually a flaw. I shouldn't say it's 20 characters. I can't remember if it's that. It's about that. Because now someone that's trying to crack it knows that they don't have to try less than that or more than that.
Yeah, except that that doesn't really matter mathematically.
You mean mathematically because it's 20 characters long and it's random, we're good.
Right. I mean, it's thinking about if you have a password that's one character long, which you shouldn't do, and that's going to be lowercase, uppercase, number, symbols, let's say 100 possibilities. Let's just do a round number like that. If you add a second character in there, it's no longer 100 possibilities. It's 100 times 100. And so...
And every time you do that, it does that.
Yes.
Yes.
And so even just by saying you have a 20-character password, you're already insurmountable. The amount of time it takes to go through each letter, like that last letter of a 20-character one, means you have to go through the entire sequence of a 19-character password,
right,
and then go to the next one and do that. I mean, so
that's why huge. You want that master password extremely well protected. You want it random. You want it large. And actually, you want all your passwords that way. And that's what these tools actually allow you to provide. So I'm in this mix, Miles. I'm in this place of, I love the idea that they're figuring out a way to make a sustainable revenue. At the same time, I don't want to hand my archive off to them. In fact, I'd rather pay and not hand it off. But I don't have a good solution for them to collect the revenue and not provide something that most people can see, oh, right, they're doing something for me all the time, and that's why I should pay them a continual revenue. Now, as Agile Bits, the company that makes 1Password, was growing, as they got more and more subscribers, more and more people using their service, I should say, they were pulling in more and more revenue. They were doing fine. It's at this peak where they're now like lots of people use them.
Everyone who has purchased it has purchased it. That right. type of thing.
And I've purchased, the iOS app, and I've purchased the main app from them. And I did that a long time ago. 1Password 3 was years ago. So I haven't given them money in a long time, and I'm still using their product. And because they have to be good at security, they're still releasing fixes, right? They're still doing stuff that I'm taking advantage of. So I get the idea of a model that they get reimbursed. I'm just concerned about the trust. But at the same time, and the post I'm kind of talking a little bit about the post. I have some disagreements about this Medium post called "Who Moved My Cheese? 1Password." But because I like 1Password and I like the general pattern, I want to chat with you. And the reason why I'm kind of like, I know this is not exactly the idea that I don't want to trust them is one thing to say, but the truth is I do, because I get updates from their software all the time. And any time they want, somebody there could just decide to log my master password and update my file and send it to them. Like, it would be very easy. It'd be trivial for them to do that without me knowing. It wouldn't be trivial for them to do that without me knowing and do it to a lot of people, because eventually it would come out and it would be public and the company would fall apart. So there's this aspect where it would have to be targeted such that it wasn't a large surface area for detection. But, federal government could come and say, hey, we really want Lyle's passwords. Can you give it to us? And if they had a court order, they'd probably do it. And therefore, then they just deploy to me, a targeted person, a backdoor for them to download the archive unencrypted from my computer, because I encrypt it all the time. So there is trust already there. It's already there. It's just, it's not baked into the general understanding. Another example of this is Skype, right? There's point-to-point communication with Skype where it gets encrypted point-to-point. But there's also a protocol that Microsoft patented right around when they took over Skype, right after they took over Skype, that says when you're doing point-to-point encryption protocol, you can also tell both systems to stop doing that and relay through a third party. And so we know they have that technology to do that. So it's true that all the time it is encrypted point to point until it's not. So trust is inherent in a software system. Do you agree?
I totally believe that. I mean, that's the same case with SSL certs. It's the same case with PGP on email.
SSL certs meaning like you have to get the cert from somebody. That company knows what the private was. They might just keep it and hijack your site.
Going along with like there's a one us what was it called again? Start SSL.
Sure.
It was a Tel Aviv based company, got bought by a Chinese company and then started doing some really wacky things. Or was it Russian?
One of the things they did, they had a vulnerability on their site where when you were about to submit what you confirm that you own the domain or the subdomain so you could get a password. Once you got that confirmation before you sent it to them, you could change in the form field what the website was, what the URL that you confirmed was, and they would approve the cert for that.
Yeah. So since then, browser manufacturers have dropped them, kind of like, you guys are no longer trustworthy, and without trust, the whole system breaks down.
So anyway, I don't mean to be flippantly like dismissive about being able to trust software vendors, but the truth is that even though we'd like to be in a situation where we could be assured that our privacy and secrecy is endured. We don't endured. That's not right.
Persisted? Is protected.
Protected.
Yeah.
We just totally are blind faith trusting it.
I don't know about blind faith. I mean, there is a trust element to it. Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So the one thing that's kind of frustrating now is if I make an account with them, they will upload the file to their server, right? And the benefit, of course, to having AgileBits upload your archive to their server and you remembering the password for your account is that you can go get that anytime you want. You can get a copy of it. So it's nice if you have your entire archive on your phone and your phone gets flushed down the toilet. All of a sudden, your passwords are still protected, which I can see from a company that for years has been saying, protect your data, because if you don't, you're totally hosed and always getting the support calls and angry letters about it. I can see them saying, let's just solve this for everybody. People need this service. So AgileBits, I get it. I totally support it. At the same time, I hope you keep supporting me being able to have my own archive. And I think they probably will for a long time because there are some companies that require that as a legal maneuver where you can't take your passwords and such and put them on a different service. All right, let's go ahead. And can you tell me about Sprint?
Or at least sprinting speeds.
Oh, I'm so sorry. I misread your post.
Jurassic Park. Get chased by a T-Rex while you're in the back of a Jeep. You know, Jeff Goldblum screaming as this T-Rex is gaining on them as they're speeding along. They can't quite shift gears.
Yes.
Turns out it may not be all that accurate.
Shocking.
As they...
What about the other ones? What about the small ones that were like human size? Could those outrun you?
Who knows? The T-Rex, I mean, you're talking about something that's on, 9 tons? They looked at the size of the bones and what the size of the muscle attachments would be, and they figured out how much it weighed. And so they found that it could probably not go any faster than 5.4 meters a second, or in American, 12 miles per hour.
So an in-shape person could outrun it.
Yes. So typical human beings can sprint anywhere between 8 and 15 miles per hour. Usain Bolt can exceed 20 miles per hour.
That's not normal. But keep in mind that we never were around them, so it doesn't really matter. Because
So
they died off a long time before we existed.
Right, but theoretically, if you were on like a pavement or ready-made track, because things change once you start getting to uneven ground, because the uneven ground would be more uneven for the human being scale than it would be for the T-Rex scale.
Yeah, but you could
also
move around things that couldn't move around. But you know, maybe you could trample stuff. But the other thing is, I don't know how fast I can run while losing my bowels. I don't know if this... Because that would be extremely scary. Yeah, a 9'10 animal on land?
Right. For a long time, they thought they could get, 45 miles an hour. But it really looks like their general day-to-day is, much, much slower, much, much closer to a brisk walk. Walking pace.
Have you heard that, one of the amazing qualities that humans actually have is the ability to outdistance other animals.
Yes. So endurance, endurance hunting. Yeah,
we can outrun anything on the planet.
It's not just that. I saw a wonderful article. I have to look it up sometime.
And when I say we, I don't mean you and I. I mean our representation of our species.
A wonderful article that was talking about the zombie apocalypse.
Oh, yeah.
But actually saying that the zombie apocalypse happened, but it happened to every other creature besides human beings. Because, like, a horse, like, runs wrong and breaks its leg.
That's a great idea. Yeah. Humans are the zombies.
Right. Right. A horse breaks its leg, and it may die just from shock. A horse in the wild breaks its leg. It's toast.
Oh, it's toast.
Human being breaks its leg, it can still limp along. It could make a brace. It can heal.
We are the zombies.
We limp, you know, just lurch along, you know.
I love the idea of, like, another animal being chased by a human. The animal, the leg, the human falls, breaks its leg. The animal's like, yes. Human gets back up, gets a stick, straps it on, starts walking.
Starts popping. No!
Yeah. Right? The dog is like, no.
Right, and you can run away from the zombie, right? Mm-hmm. But you get tired, and the zombie just keeps coming and keep. That's the whole point of many of these horror films. And we just keep coming. We just, like, have a little bladder that we drink our water out of, and we just keep going. We are the zombie apocalypse to this to this planet.
I guess maybe it's the Neanderthal, right? The Neanderthal was the one that really realize that about us. They don't stop. Hey, look, I made art. Oh no, what's that thing that's coming towards me?
Right, and it all sounds horrible right now. It isn't quite the sanitized, genteel version that we get from, you know, from David Attenborough. And the animal has now come to exhaustion with it. Human being in the oldest form of hunting merely strikes
running.
Yeah, merely strikes the deciding blow, not due to a need, for the animal would really already die from exhaustion, but merely in a ceremonial manner.
When did you take on other voices? That was fantastic.
I practice my David Attenborough.
Better than Waterworld. It's amazing. Do tell me about what's going on in police cameras.
We talked about body cameras extensively.
Yes.
And they've come up repeatedly. In fact, there was one case recently where officer did not realize that the body camera was on as he was conspiring with others to plant drugs on suspects. And that's how we hope that the body cams will work, not so much that we think that all police officers are corrupt, but that they will provide an objective view into these events. Well, the next phase is happening. It wasn't just going to be about recording. Now we're looking at facial recognition.
Automatic facial recognition.
Yes.
On body cams.
Now, the worry that I have is a long-standing issue with facial recognition, like with cameras, is, for example, blink detection largely has failed for people of Asian descent. Like the algorithms were made with Caucasians in mind.
You mean the situation when your camera will, like, take a pic, you push the shutter down, but the camera's looking for all the eyes to be open at the same time, a large group shot,
yes,
and then fired at that time.
Yes.
Fails for Asian eyes.
Yes.
East Asian
eyes. Quite often, yes. And
also a white balance for black skin, darker skin.
Yeah, not just that, but also when it's doing head tracking.
Yeah.
For African Americans, it fails a lot to notice that they've entered the frame, whereas for Caucasians.
Because of skin tone?
Yes. And that white balance.
When you said head tracking, all I could imagine was a chicken. Did I show you that video of someone taking a really small camera and putting it on their rooster and using it as a steady cam?
No.
Because if you take a chicken, move around the body, it's like all steady. So they actually put a little camera on the head
that's
of the chicken
awesome.
And showed it off.
Need to do that. I have chickens. I can do that.
You got to do that. You got to get a really small camera, though, because you don't want to piss off a chicken.
A hen, who cares?
Dude.
And hens do the same thing.
Roosters, too, except they bite your face. Anyway, you were saying.
So in this article, it's talking, quoting here from the defenseone.com. Even if the cop who pulls you over doesn't recognize you, the body camera on his chest eventually might. Here's that question of how good is this information?
Well, but
when we already know that there are issues with commercial software out there in detecting people of different ethnicities and the accuracy therein, you have to err either on the side of false positives or false negatives. And if you're erring on those false positives, then you have to really worry, because the accuracy is low, you have to worry about, oh, they all look alike, but in the technical sense.
But isn't facial recognition more about, like, I mean, it is pretty good, isn't it? In the sense that doesn't it, like, it's got to do a relatively good job.
Or people wouldn't use it. It depends. No, facial recognition, people will, if you're in the commercial field, pretty good facial recognition is obviously better than no facial recognition at all.
But when you're trying to identify a criminal,
when you're trying to deal with, yeah, or even if someone who isn't a criminal, when I'm talking about false positive, that's the one I'm more concerned
about. No, that's what I'm saying. It's like, yeah. False positive is definitely a problem. Because it will, I mean,
because you're
even at a high percentage chance, yes, of success, you're going to have a lot more false positives than you would assume.
Yeah, you have a stress level in this job that already exists, and there's a stress level in being a non-police officer interacting with law enforcement. To then add in errors from detection.
Well, let me ask you this. What if, to use this feature, the camera just always has to be on? Wouldn't it be better in the sense that you'd get police operating by the rules in more effective ways if the camera was always on?
Sure, they would.
And also, I mean, just to argue the point of it.
Well, the thing is, with cameras aren't after the fact
thing. Inspection thing. Sure.
So them being on is good for evidentiary purposes, and they don't necessarily affect the interactions over and above that everyone knows that recordings are going on, that the person knows they're being recorded and the police officer knows they're recording. That changes when you have facial recognition going on and then providing cues to the officer. Is that happening in real time? Is that being fed back to a partner in the car? What happens if you get that false positive and suddenly that stressful situation, that already stressful situation, becomes a fight or flight response?
Yeah, I get the downsides of the potential problem, but I definitely see the benefits as well. I mean, if you've got someone that's a wanted criminal and they're lying about they have a fake identity, or they're lying that they don't have their papers and the camera can match them, isn't that a good thing?
Yes, and you're speaking of the theoretical, and I'm speaking of I'm fairly light complexion, so I'm probably going to have a pretty good...
You seem a little darker complexion now.
Yes, I just spent a vacation in Catalina Island, but...
Did you wear sunscreen?
I did, which is why I wasn't burned. I'm just tanned. Mm.
Tan is still skin damage.
Okay.
I'm just saying. Go on. You look good, sir.
But when we talk about interactions with law enforcement, you can't speak of it in terms of, well, it could be good, and it probably will work out well, you know, for Caucasians, because facial recognition works best with that demographic. If you're speaking of a demographic that already has a troubled history with law enforcement.
I get that, yeah.
Increasing a potential danger, or rather, you know, taking that potential already and then putting it up a little bit for more risk is not so easy to shrug off.
I get that. What you're saying is that, you know, so someone pulls you over, you happen to have a computer matching face to someone who's like a wanted criminal that's, you know, armed, considered dangerous, and armed and dangerous, right? And so that's what the police officer all of a sudden gets. They talk with you for 10 seconds, and all of a sudden they get a red flag, a buzzer in their pocket that says this person's dangerous, and all of a sudden they pull their gun on you, and the whole situation has gotten really bad because of a stupid software problem, right? That's kind of a concern you've got, right?
Right.
And I get that. I totally get that.
Or for that matter, for the police officer, they go into a situation and it doesn't detect the person.
And so they get used to it detecting, and all of a sudden it doesn't.
So, yeah, it's that how close to 100% accurate does this need to be before you deploy it out in the field?
By the way, the chicken-powered Steadicam is by the guy that does Smarter Every Day, which is a great YouTube channel. I will link to it at geekspeak.org. All right, let's go on to Glassdoor. Weren't we talking earlier about the transparency of salaries and stuff?
Yes.
And you actually have a whole article about Glassdoor?
Yes. Glassdoor, I thought, talked about a few other things as well.
But Glassdoor is also a place where you can take a look at salaries of different people in different areas.
Yes.
Okay. So what's this story about?
The story here is that people have said the government should not have access to anonymous users on Glassdoor, because part of the way that Glassdoor works is that you have been anonymized, that you are able to report information for business practices, for salaries, for things like that. But the Ninth Circuit Court has ruled that First Amendment rights and protections don't apply for trying to get a subpoena for this information because it's, quote, not political speech.
Wait.
It's not political.
Wait. Who argued this?
This is going through the Ninth Circuit Court.
Okay, so a pretty high court is saying that your secrecy on Glassdoor and the reviews of companies and such is not protected because it's not political speech. How can a person's opinion about another service or company not be political? I mean, and why would political be?
This is that notion that if you're talking about the government, you're talking about government policies, obvious First Amendment, obviously political. Right, and if you're having interactions with law enforcement, what you can do, it's obviously political.
Because the arm of the government, it's okay to talk about. Okay.
Right. Then when you get into private companies, it becomes far less clear.
So if I work for a company and they've told me, hey, don't tell anybody, but on Sundays we cook up hamsters. And then later I write a review saying, hey, that company serves hamsters at noon on Wednesdays. Then that is not protected as public or as political speech because it's a private business thing.
Yeah.
I kind of see the argument of that. I mean, you wouldn't want an employee to talk about how your assembly line actually functions, even if a patent existed on it.
Well, a trade secret is one thing.
Well,
what grilling hamsters is
devious and evil?
Yeah.
I mean, or were you going to say delicious? You were going to say delicious.
That's where you get into that area of if you are not violating a
trade secret.
Yes. Not violating.
Well, give me an example. Like you've refrained from speaking about some things at your former employer, Google, because you didn't feel appropriate to share that publicly because they didn't want to share it publicly. So even though it's not necessarily a trade secret, that's kind of the representation of
a business process or, you know, things like that. I'm much more reluctant to.
Okay. Can you tell me an example like the hamster thing that you like? What would be something that you think is appropriate to speak about on Glassdoor, but the company wouldn't want to be public and defending both the position of the individual talking about that, like you would in political speech, versus the company having its own right to privacy if a company.
Sexual or racial harassment within. Executives within companies so that you weren't able to get anywhere because HR is essentially on the side of the employer. They were
a great example would be that the story coming out about Uber. We've talked about many times about employees being harassed when they left, wrote a really wonderful blog post kind of bringing that to light, that issue. Theoretically, if it wasn't appropriate, if it's not political speech, then it's talking privately about a company. The company could theoretically sue that individual.
Right. And that comes into question of what do we consider politics?
Right. Well, the other question is like a corporation is an entity that is created by the government.
Has a government charter, yeah.
So it is an arm of a government in some nature. It doesn't have an identity without the government approval, unlike you and I who have existence without government
approval. This is an area where we're talking about hypotheticals in practice with the U.S., it's not the case. I mean, hence
because lawyers
and wealthy people who don't.
And
want
I brought that as a red herring. I'm totally aware that companies don't have that. There's not a perspective in the United States that companies are arms of the government. Just it's a fun way of thinking about it. But in any case, what you're saying is that the Glassdoor, the high level court has said that those are not protected public speech. The reviews on Glassdoor. So therefore, what? The individual's identity can be known by the company, so the company can then sue them. I mean, what is it that's going to emerge from this?
That basically comes down to it that reviews are not protected. They can subpoena to find out the identity of the person given certain circumstances.
I'm assuming what Glassdoor has done is allowed people to post stuff. Yeah. And the idea is that the Glassdoor needs to verify that you work there. So they're like, you're like, want to say something about hamster eating at Google. And so you go to Glassdoor and say, hey, I'm a former Google employee. And they say, prove it. And you kind of somehow prove it. And now your review gets ranked higher because you once worked there and you can talk about delicious hamsters. And then therefore Google come and sue Glassdoor to find out who you were so they could sue you. That kind of idea.
Yeah.
Right? And to be clear, you never ate a hamster.
No.
Right?
I've never
It's all candy at Google because it's all the Android.
So the case here, federal investigators were looking for identities of more than 100 anonymous users. Glassdoor pushed back on that. And so the government later scaled back its demand for just 8 people. And this from Ars Technica, the prosecutors believe that 8 Glassdoor users are, quote, third-party witnesses to certain business practices relevant to the investigation. The name of the company under investigation is redacted from all the...
Oh, interesting. So wait, so the federal government is doing an investigation. They see that there's evidence on Glassdoor. They want to talk to those individuals. Glassdoor says no privacy. And those individuals are maybe not even told that they want to be spoken to because there's no way to communicate with them. And so this is so they're actually trying to investigate a crime?
Well, the thing is, this is a case where this would allow subpoena power. That's different from the federal government saying we're looking for people who have, you know, they could even go to Glassdoor and say, "Hey, we want to get information from this. Please contact us." Like there are other ways to do it besides subpoena power,
right? Right.
So that's where it gets iffy from me looking at it here. I am not a lawyer, but
I understand. You can read up about this and other things at geekspeak.org, where we post a whole bunch of notes about the show and links and all that fun stuff, including you can watch the video from there about the chicken can, which I highly recommend. Today's episode is Nordic Passwords Are Made From Chips, Salt, Fat, Paint, and Zombies. This is episode 26 of season 17, Geekspeak. The title to this show is by Greg Merkley, obviously. Awesome title. And the theme song, as it is every week, is by Michael Newman, Pet Star Music. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I want to thank you, Mr. Miles Elam, for joining me today on Geekspeak.
Always a pleasure.
I'd also like to thank you for listening to this program. We do it for love. Thanks for enjoying it. We'll see you next week.